Assuming the government will let you stay in business, and assuming that you can get raw materials without government or market interference, you still have to get it to market. So our next session, we're going to talk about transportation, and we're pleased to welcome Daryl Penn from C.H. Robinson Worldwide. Daryl's the business development manager from the Atlanta office. He started with C.H. Robinson in 1997, and he's been through a variety of, started in sales, and he's worked up through logistics and been embedded in a Fortune 500 company for some time to learn the logistics and development side of transportation planning. So he's here to talk to us today about what we can expect for the rest of 2012 and 2013 transportation markets. So, Daryl, welcome.
Sure. Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me. It's good. In my 15 years here, the first five or so, no one really wanted to talk about supply chain. It was just the last link, but we talk about how it's moved from the back room to the boardroom and good supply chain being a competitive advantage for folks. So my colleagues from Minnesota, if you can't tell from the accent, I'm not one of those guys from Minnesota, but I have a couple here, and they suggested I start out the session with a hearty go Dawgs. But as a Georgia Tech alum and the son of a Georgia Tech alum, I think that might take me out of the wheel, so I don't know if I can do that. But just a few opening comments here, just to run through the agenda. I'm going to give just a super brief Robinson overview. I promise it won't be a commercial, just to kind of establish, you know, our place in the market for those that don't know. We'll move into regulatory issues and impact, market capacity. When I first got the email that they needed me to do this speaking, they said they wanted a forecast for the market. The bad news is Robinson doesn't issue those, so everything you'll see in here is quotes and taken from other sources and some anecdotal stuff that I hear as part of my role now. Bob mentioned I run the business development group, so I get in front of a lot of clients, both on the shipper side and the carrier side, to hear their concerns. And I did spend about a year and a half on the customer side of the desk working actually embedded at the Clorox Freight operations in Alpharetta. So. But we'll talk through some of the market capacity, driver shortage, what there are some forecasts out for cost and what the equipment capacity looks like. And then hopefully in the back half we'll spend more time on what you can actually do. There's only limited influence we can have on the market, but there are certain ways to react and plan for it and try and minimize the impact to your business. So, in the vein of marketplace forecasts and behaviors, I thought I'd bring a few here just so you know this is, again, a forecast and none of us can really control it. So the first quote is from Thomas Watson, 1943. I think there's a world market for maybe five computers. I think he missed that one by just a little bit. In 2002, the 1 billionth PC was built and shipped, and just in 5 years from there, the second billion were built and shipped. So, second one says, over 50 foreign cars already on sale here. The Japanese auto industry is not likely to carve out a big slice of the U.S. market from 1968. I thought about that as I drove here in my Honda this morning. And then there were, I think, 12 of the 27 best-selling cars last year were Japanese makes, including the Toyota Camry, the number one passenger sedan. And then lastly, while theoretically and technically television may be feasible, commercially and financially it's an impossibility. So just to get some background on that, I looked it up last night. Nielsen estimates that this year will be down a little bit. There are only 114.7 million television households, down from 115.9 million. And of those 114.7, 56% own three or more televisions. So I think he missed just a little bit on that one, too. So hopefully I won't swing and miss as bad moving into some of these market things. But again, one more quote about uncertainty. I saw this when I was traveling a couple weeks ago from Michael Ward, head of the CSX. Anybody's best guess is not a good guess because of all the uncertainty. Bob and I were talking before, and I told him if anybody in here could guarantee me absolutely what's going to happen next Tuesday, we might start to define a little more direction. But obviously, there is a lot of uncertainty both in the overall marketplace and in the transportation marketplace. So, the other thing I thought about when I thought about that is I sat in a similar room to this probably in 2006 and listened to a really well-respected speaker talking about diesel fuel, and I believe his chart said we should be paying over $9 a gallon for diesel right now based on his projections. So, again, things change and markets correct. So, again, I promise to keep this minimum two slides, and this slide, if all goes well today, will be completely wrong as we hope to close our acquisition of Phoenix International later today. So, but currently, as we stand this morning, about a $10.3 billion company with 107 years experience, 235 offices globally, about 180 in North America, which you'll see on the next slide. The big piece here is 10 million shipments handled in 2011, which does include our managed business through our subsidiary company, TMC. So we get a lot of look at a lot of data around what's going on in the marketplace. 37,000 customers and 53,000 different carriers across road, rail, air. So again, we have conversations with a lot of folks on both sides. So we think we have a pretty good line of sight on what's going on. We'll get into that a little bit here. And then this is just network, just to show we're on the ground in different markets. So while we try and give a holistic view, you know, things do change in certain markets compared to others. I've heard our CEO mention a lot of times now, with so much automation and technology in the market, it reminds him how the stock market jumps up and down. The amplitude gets higher and lower. They tend to compress a little bit. Maybe they don't last as long, those spikes, but they tend to be a little more violent when they do happen. So. Let's start with some, as Bob referenced, that government interference. We'll start with a couple of things there. I won't get much into CSA, what they call 2010, as we sit here on the horizon of 2013, just because there's still a lot of uncertainty about how those things will be determined and applied. But we will touch a little bit on the hours of service here. Scheduled for a July implementation in 2013. Who knows if that will happen? It kind of reminds me of the CSA 2010 thing. They put a year on it, and who knows? But it is scheduled there. There's the GAO report will come out in 13, which could have an influence. And there is some pending litigation. The ATA filed suit against those hours of service and claimed to place an undue burden on drivers and their ability to make a living. The OIDA and a couple of other organizations joined as interveners in support of the ATA's position on that. That lawsuit was then consolidated and assigned to a three-judge panel. There's some highway safety groups that are on the opposite side of that lawsuit that do want those changes to go through. And I believe all briefs are due like the 21st of this month to start that process rolling. So don't know exactly how that'll play out, but just to touch on some of the what they talk about there, the largest change is the move to a once-per-week reset. The reason behind that was what they call cumulative fatigue, and I guess they would liken that to, I guess, using an example from my own life. I spent last week, started off in Cincinnati, Ohio, on the first flight out of Atlanta Monday morning, flew Cincy to Dallas, Dallas to Querétaro, Mexico, and stayed there for the rest of the week. They don't go to bed particularly early down there, so some nice 20 and 22-hour days, and then start again. So this week's been tough. I was telling Bob I was due to be in Baltimore and Cranberry, New Jersey this week, and they had a little weather event going on up there, so that got postponed, but it was good for me to be able to rest, step back a little bit this week and take it a little easier. They changed that rule because so many drivers didn't really do that. They reset that week, go hard again, you know, take their break, go hard again the next week. And they felt like after some studies that cumulative fatigue led to a lot of the problems that drivers were having. So that's the biggest reset. There, I think, and talking to Jason Craig, who is our government affairs manager, you won't see a huge impact on a load-by-load basis because those hours haven't really changed. It's 14 hours on duty, 11 hours driving. The only change there is the insertion of a mandatory 30-minute break within the first 8 hours of driving. But the reality is most of those guys we're taking a little break, whether it be to get fuel, get something to eat. Within that first 8 hours, they're going to stop and break anyway. So on your load-to-load basis, I don't think, and we don't think, you'll see a huge impact there. I do have a link there, and I can send this to Bob, and you can share with whoever. On our website, there are some blogs, some white papers and stuff. And like I say, anything you see by Jason Craig, is typically around government regulations, whether it be hours of service, CSA, what you can do to prepare. So if you want to go to our website and look into, that comes from our Transportfolio blog series where there's a lot of stuff there. But like I say, there are case studies and white papers that are all free of charge if you want to sign yourself up to get some updates there. Jason does a pretty good job of making updates as things go through. So on a year-by-year basis for the carrier, the example he gave me was if a carrier's maybe going to haul 100 loads in a year, maybe with this new kind of mandatory reset being a hard set, that maybe they'll do 98 instead of 100. So they'll try and price that through, you know, that two-load loss kind of across the other 98. So moving over to fuel efficiency standards, we anticipate probably some more difficulty in certain states or markets with that. The California Air Resources Board being an example of one that, you know, if you look out, that we would anticipate being tougher. Right now, their biggest legislative acts are around actual transport reefer units, TRUs they call them. And they'll start, I think it's either this month or next, they'll start fining, whether it be the forwarder, the broker, the shipper, the carrier, kind of who they deem to be the applicable party. If you send a reefer unit into California that doesn't have a CARB-approved sticker for efficiency in that TRU unit. So I don't think it's a huge leap to think of them regulating even further on the actual output of the trucks, different things there. So increased efficiency requirements in miles per gallon, things do add to the cost of new equipment, which layer costs back into the carrier. Some of your smaller carriers I've heard in different things. I was at CSEMP National back at the start of this month, and some of the carriers saying they were trading in two trucks to get one based on the value of the used and then the increase in the cost of the new equipment. And you will see things like the CNG, some of the bigger carriers. In fact, at that CSEMP panel, John Roberts from J.B. Hunt was on a panel and gave some opinions on CNG trucks. I think if I summarize his take right, he didn't necessarily see the huge benefit of it. It still has some struggles in that technology on longer haul freight and on heavier freight in the CNG world. And then just from an infrastructure standpoint, when you take out across the country, you've got to plan places where you can stop and fuel. Obviously, there's not near as many of those as there are diesel for these guys to fuel up. That last point there, in talking to Jason and talking to some shippers, the bigger problem, it doesn't really matter how efficient the engine is if you can't move. I saw in the registration someone from Scottson, Jackson, Georgia, and I thought about that as an example. If a truck driver leaves Jackson, Georgia at 3:30 heading north into Atlanta, it doesn't matter how efficient his engine is. He's going to be idling along, creeping along. So, you know, when he gets to the top of the city to get towards, you know, if he wants to go towards Chattanooga or if he gets towards one side of 8, you know, to go towards Charlotte on 85, he's not going to open up for an hour or two. So he's just idling and creeping along there. So there's bigger problems there than you can regulate whatever. When I started back in the industry in 97, you know, really good trucks were getting 6 miles per gallon, and you know, a lot of trucks now are getting 6 miles per gallon. The technology's changed a lot, the output necessarily hasn't. So moving on to heavyweight shipments, which I know is probably a big topic for some folks in this room. Just some background on it. There was a provision for increased, I guess, I don't want to say code word, but truck productivity was how it was deemed in there, initially included in the transportation bill that was recently passed through, supported by the Coalition for Transportation Productivity. It would have raised the legal limit to 97,000 pounds instead of the 80,000 pounds currently. The trade-off there was you get an extra axle for that extra 17,000. A lot of debate on both sides. Railroads are against that from probably a competitive position. And actually, surprisingly, not surprising that safety was the big thing that people talked about and worried about. I think people may have been a little surprised by some of the lobbies of the police and firefighters against that rule, saying they weren't ready to respond to accidents involving 97,000 pound trucks. So the amendment was, an amendment was put forth to strip that piece and convert it to just a study, bipartisan vote, and that amendment passed 33-22. And in fact, I believe, and I'm not 100% sure, but I believe John Duncan Jr. actually went against Mike on that as two Republicans. I think they were on opposite sides of that vote. So at the end of the day, there's no anticipated movement on that until they debate the next transportation bill 2 years from now. So we are where we are on that. You're going to be at your 80,000 pound limit there. We'll move just quickly to touch on a few market capacity things. Quick show of hands, anybody have young kids at home? And are you training them to be a long-haul truck driver by chance? Or so, you know, there's just not a lot of that. That is the biggest gap, is long-haul trucking. Dedicated trucking, some of those hauls, the short-haul stuff. And please don't take that as a knock. My father-in-law was a trucker, recently retired. And obviously, as a third party in the industry, we have a lot of appreciation for what drivers do. It's a tough job, and I couldn't do it. So when I tease about training your kids to do that, again, I don't want that to come across as demeaning at all, but there's just not a lot of people that are doing that. So there's different projections out there. I went with the Bureau of Labor Statistics, but I actually saw an article that Paige Siplon from the Georgia Logistics Innovation Center was quoted in just this week with some different projections on the shortage. But the BLS predicts that the industry will add 330,000 trucking jobs prior to 2020. The ETA reports a current shortage of 20 to 30,000 drivers in their most recent quarterly report around trucking activity. And obviously there are a lot of barriers in there. The lifestyle probably being the toughest. Being away from your family for days, if not weeks at a time, living out of the back of a truck cab is probably not an ideal scenario for a lot of people when they envision that. The training requirements are pretty tough. Truck driving school can cost $4,000 to $6,000 and take 4 to 8 weeks, depending. And then even once you're graduated, some carriers don't want to take a chance. Again, working back to that CSA, they want an established driver with a good, clean record. So you are starting to see some more carriers open up their own driver schools and driver training, come up with a lot of creative recruiting incentives. I don't remember the carrier I saw, but I saw someone had just put a bunch of press releases out about trying to recruit military veterans that were discharging from the military into truck driving. There's other things out there. Immigrant drivers can close probably some of that gap. If any of you guys are up in that Chicago market, you see a lot of Eastern European drivers, Southeast and Southwest, a lot of Hispanic drivers. Don't know that they'll close that gap all the way. I think that's another reason you see some rise in intermodal shipments. If you're looking at the earnings for Norfolk Southern, CSX, and the other railroads, people are using intermodal shipping to bridge that long-haul portion and try and avoid that shortage, because the long-haul driver is the largest shortage. And the demographic is that's an older driver who will be retiring over the next 5 to 10 years. So these carriers are trying to get ahead of that, come up with the replacements now. So here's maybe another reason why driving hasn't taken off in popularity. The black line is the consumer price index. Private industry workers is the blue line, and then wages and salaries for drivers is that red chained line. So when you see it significantly below the CPI and what you can do in other jobs, add that on to the lifestyle stuff that we touched on, and you can see why it's been less than attractive career option for folks. So obviously, the driver pool will directly have an impact on potentially truck availability. There are some lower tonnage projections through 2019 out there. When I started putting this together, active dry van utilization was trending towards 100%, meaning there's a real balance in supply and demand. It's actually backed up just a little bit, I heard on a call yesterday. But I think a long-term trend still towards that balanced market is where you'll see it. Unfortunately, operating costs to the carrier are rising faster than they're able to pass on increases, so that's a trend that's not a sustainable long-term trend. They can't pay to haul freight, so as additional regulations and different things increase their costs. The problem they have there is trucking is a lot more of a demand-driven market than a cost-driven market. They can have a certain underlying cost, but if the rest of the market is not getting to that point of demand, or a shipper doesn't need to hire at that rate, a carrier has the option to basically park that truck, which you've seen a lot of them do over the last, since 2009, or just exit the game entirely, which, again, you saw a lot do, truck bankruptcies in record levels in 2009, 2010. But until you see some of those operating ratios improve, and some of that demand and the rate go higher, you won't see a ton of equipment being added into the pool. A lot of the equipment that's being added in now is replacement for retiring fleets, older trucks or older trailers that they sell and exit. They replace that capacity, but it doesn't result in an incremental increase in a carrier's capacity. And again, when they're struggling to get the rates they want, you won't see them flood the market with extra drivers and trailers ready to go. So getting down to the money, what do costs look like for the coming year? And again, for public relations benefit, I will reiterate, this is not necessarily a Robinson forecast. These are our forecasts gathered from some other folks who try and predict the industry. But these type of analysts, your FTR, Baird, Stevens, those folks seem to be broadly influenced by that GDP growth around 2%, and then around the impact of hours of service and the Comprehensive Safety Act. So forecasts has ranged from 2% to 5% increase on cost, van rates on the lower side, reefer and flatbeds on the higher side, and that's really just the supply and demand. If you drive around 285 and circle the city here, you'll see a lot more enclosed van trailers than you will the other equipment. You know, when there's more supply in that piece, there's less leverage for the carrier and less ability to pass those rate increases they want through there. So this is just as an example. I got charts on the next couple just to give you some of the analysts trending. This is from Stevens Equity Research. You can see the rate creep drop back down, obviously, going into that recession of 09, but has started to climb again. This is only through first quarter of 12. I don't have the most recent chart they put forth, but the line I've seen, and the line tends to tick just a little bit further up. So, and you'll see down at the bottom, it's just some, they have a formula to measure loaded rates per truckload mile, largely at the publicly traded carriers that dig information out of the 10Ks for the larger publicly traded carriers and then plot them into this index. So, this is a kind of showing the expenditures for freight versus the shipment volume. So you'll see that gap starting to widen there on the left. That's from Cass Information Systems, Freight Payables Company. And then the active truck utilization measure that I mentioned starting to tick towards that 100%, and that's courtesy of FTR Associates there. So we've heard a little bit about what the market's anticipated to do and what we see going on. Now we'll get into some things you can do to prepare yourself. And this is from an article that we just published in Enterprise Minnesota Magazine called The 10 Steps to a Smarter Supply Chain. Before I get into the 10, just kind of overarching advice. I've heard one of my contacts at Coke refer to freight as a beauty contest. When you get into that pool and carriers are having to pick which loads they want to haul, there are certain little things you can do. And that varies probably by carrier as to what they think is important. But building that collaborative relationship with your key partners is big. Whether it be faster pay, consistent volume, an aggregation of your low volume lanes to make an award to a carrier, there's a lot of different things. You know, I mentioned my father-in-law recently retired from trucking, and I asked him, you know, what were some of the shippers you liked versus didn't like? And he is a forced dispatch driver for a chemical company called Ashland Chemical, but he would get kind of his choice, hey, you can go deliver this load or this load based on his seniority. And he said simple things you wouldn't think of, like a nice, clean, accessible driver bathroom. He said his favorite place had a really nice, clean bathroom and free sodas that you could get out of their fridge. So something just as simple as that, it's a fairly low-cost impact. You get the driver to prefer you versus other places, and then, you know, and that can snowball up to other things. So just a little anecdotal story about small things you can do. Getting into these 10 steps, first one, do not try and time the market. A lot of people do that. You would no more try and time the stock market with your personal money when you're going to dive in or out than you would the freight. A lot of times people think they see at the bottom, they want to lock in those rates. We've done a study in conjunction with Iowa State University that shows that over time, typically that shipper ends up paying more than the shipper who does some of these other steps that we'll get into. Second, benchmark your rates just to know where you stand relative to the market. You may think it's a great rate. You may benchmark and find out that it's not as good as you thought. You may find out you're right where you need to be. When I think about that, I think about anything you purchase now. If you have a QR reader on your phone, when you go in a store for a big ticket item, you can scan that thing and your phone will tell you what the prices of other options are, whether it be similar products or nearby stores, you can compare. I think about transportation in the same way. And there's a lot of different places you can get that. A lot of companies that offer, Chainalytics, a big Atlanta-based company that offers that service. And I'm not endorsing that, there's one that came to mind. But there are a lot of places you can go and see what trucking market behaviors are, whether it be month over month or year over year, what you're wanting to compare. The next advice we give is conduct a procurement exercise at the same time of the year every year. We talked about a little earlier, carriers love that stability, to be able to plan their network based on knowing when that freight's going to move. They know when they're going to be pricing your exercise. At CSCMP, when we presented our research that we had did with Iowa State, folks asked, is there a particular right time? I think the guidance was there's not necessarily a right month or a right time. You see a lot of shippers do that stuff in the early part of the year. January, February, carriers will tell you they're super busy with bids at that time of year. So again, the time probably doesn't matter as much as they can count on you to know when you're going to be bidding or when you're going to be making your awards. So the next one seems obvious, but share the truth about the business. Being in this 15 years, I can tell you, I can think of plenty of examples where folks weren't entirely honest about what something looks like. They generalize it out, they divide it by the year. Hey, it's X number of loads a year. Well, that might be true, but they say it's 100 loads a year, but it's 25 loads every quarter end. Every Friday at quarter end, you know, that same day, when a carrier's thinking about it, they're trying to plan that consistency around there. So be as forthcoming as you can about what the business actually looks like. You'll get a better, more sustainable solution from the carrier. You know, they'll kind of play whichever game, but they got to understand what the game is and what the rules are if they're going to give you their best foot forward. So the fifth one says, understand that routing guide depth drives transportation costs. A lot of shippers build their budgets based on that first carrier accepting that load, and there are certain things you can do to try and increase that acceptance percentage. But where your costs really get driven is when that first carrier doesn't take and you're working down the routing guide further and further. I thought I had some number. Oh, yeah, here it is. There's an MIT study that we published that you can get in a white paper that suggests you pay an average of 6 cents per mile more in rate for each time the load gets rejected as it works down your routing guide. So when you get into the 2-3 carrier, it also, the likelihood of acceptance falls with each carrier you go down the list. So that fifth carrier, he's never seen that load. It gets to be a tight capacity time. There's the odds that he's going to accept that get smaller and smaller as you go further and further down. Again, building on that theme, understand that lead time affects the likelihood that your preferred carrier will accept a load. In that same MIT study, it showed that they're very likely to accept a load with 48 hours lead time or more. The lower you get, the less likely they are to accept that load. And again, backing up to point five, if you want that first carrier to accept that load, try and give them as much lead time as you possibly can. And again, you can get that white paper. It's called Increased Lead Time, Decreased Cost, free of charge on our website. So, number seven, hire a procurement expert to run that procurement exercise. There are certain spreadsheets you can send out, you can do things, but the more sophisticated you are in your bid tool, the more accurate it's going to be, the better supply chain plan you're going to have. We recommend a web-based tool. It's easier for everybody to respond to. That procurement expert can help you build the data that you need to put an effective bid out. And then we prefer a constraint-based bid tool so they can say, hey, I don't want any carrier to have more than X percentage of the business. I want incumbents to have X percentage of the business. You can move around and they'll come up with multiple scenarios, lay them out for you, and you can make a choice there about which way you want to go. After completing the procurement exercise, you use a TMS to measure performance. You know, a lot of times without a TMS, you're anecdotally trying to figure out carrier performance. How good was someone? Did they take the percentage of loads they promised they would take? If you don't have a way to monitor that, it helps in carrier negotiations. You go back and say, hey, you're asking for an increase, you're only accepting the load 75% of the time. It gives you, arms you with information you can take back to them. It'll give you carrier scorecards, client scorecards. It'll help you understand your cost to serve certain business and the profitability on business there. You can get item level detail. But the big overarching theme there is it just allows you to view where the holes are in your supply chain using actual hard data instead of using just your gut, what something feels like to you from a performance standpoint. Number nine, maintain a stable set of corporate service providers year to year. It's a little tough as a sales guy to stand up here and say that. I'm not saying 100%, hey, you lock in your carrier base and no one ever leaves and no one ever comes in. Competition is good for your business. It's good for the carriers. It increases everybody's performance typically. But too much churn increases the risk to your supply chain, particularly around market timing. If you flip half your carriers over, if you're running annual procurement exercises, by the time that new carrier kind of learns the flow and patterns of the business and really gets into things, it's time to go again. If you just keep flipping constantly, so again, as somebody who earns their living trying to convince people to add us in where we're not in, it's tough to say, but keeping that core, and again, going back to the constraint-based bid tool, whether it's, hey, I want 80% to be awarded to incumbents or 85%, you have to make that decision about what's right for your business. But keeping that core, and the carrier knows they can count on you, they know you're going to be there year for year. You know, the guy, you're not going to flip for a cent a mile, that kind of thing. You value that long-term relationship. You're typically going to be able to leverage a better cost from the carrier over the long haul doing it that way. So, and then last, just understand what drives fluctuations in the market. There's certain, no one can know for sure what's going on, but there's certain indicators you can watch to understand what's driving the market. Capacity availability tends to be driven by economic change. So you see a big uptick. Some new shipper moved in down the street and they're shipping more loads. You have to be aware kind of what's going on around you so that you can go have those conversations. And again, leading back to that point, going to your core carrier and saying, hey, look, and I know this is hot right now, but I'm going to be here year-round. Don't go chase the dollar when you get into your produce seasons or your retail seasons. You know, stick with me because I'm going to provide you this. I'm going to feed you all year. You can build your network around me. It goes a long way to helping you with those costs. So, again, there are indexes you can watch to show changes. Week by week, month by month, year over year, FTR Associates puts one out. You can see some different trends in the marketplace. So, and that actually will bring me to conclusion with about half the time left. So if there are questions or thoughts, ideas, we'd be glad to take them. I've got a couple of colleagues here that I'll assign to answer any question that I don't know the answer to. So.
You showed equipment utilization. Do you have anything that talks about the equipment volume or the trend in the past few years on how much is out there?
You know, I don't have in there, and I wouldn't want to hazard a guess. If you want to, I'll trade cards with you if you want. We do have a guy who does a lot of our market research who probably can put his hands on some stuff there to show you what that pool looks like.
Yeah, what would you speculate as far as what the trend is? Is the equipment availability or volume be up, down, flat?
I depend probably on the time frame you're looking at. I would think the last 6 months to a year, it's been fairly balanced. You know, I think from 09 to 11, a lot of equipment left. But that was really masked by no demand for it. Nobody really noticed it leaving that much because there wasn't a ton of economic demand for shipping. If we would have had a big economy, and of course, if we'd have had a big economy, a lot of shipping, probably not as much would have left. But had there been an uptick, I think you would have felt it more. So I think there probably is less equipment, but again, there's less demand for that equipment too. So, you know, it's funny on that last point. A good illustration this week when you think about short-term market changes, obviously, with the weather going on in the Northeast, a lot of carriers moving over to FEMA, relief loads, hauling generators, doing those kind of things. It's going to cause a ripple in certain markets. You know, think about there's no freight coming out of the Northeast right now because they don't have power, so your typical carriers who are back hauling back to the Northeast won't be around, and that ripple effect will be felt because then you're having to go to backup carriers, you're having to go to head haul markets and do some different things. So being aware of those kind of trends and how they affect things and what they do to the market is important there. So. Any other questions or?
Sure. There's newer technologies about dual fuel systems, diesel over propane or natural gas. Can you comment on your perspective?
I don't have a ton of perspective necessarily outside of, like, say, what I talked about with John Robertson here. And I have heard a couple of customers that talk about, you know, the CNG stuff working for just, and again, this is a broad comment, but more on like a short haul dedicated. Hey, I have a DC here and I want to service my customer 25 miles down the road and I have a CNG filling place I can get to. I think there's a lot of benefits in that. Again, I heard comments from a couple of shippers and from Mr. Roberts about those struggling with a heavier load, you know, your 45.5, 45.7 type van shipment, those struggle a little bit more. Probably gets down to literally depending on terrain you're at. You're making a 20-mile run kind of in a flat area. You're trying to do a, you know, in a more mountainous region, that kind of thing. I think there's some impact there. Again, I'm probably not as close to that in my role as some of those guys are, but from an overarching standpoint, I think they see some benefit in it. The other side of that is the equipment is significantly more, so you have to be able to prove out that ROI before you jump into that. Yeah, the CNG is obviously a lot cheaper as a fuel source and probably getting cheaper as we have more and more of that available. So I think it bears watching pretty closely. But again, based on the cost of the equipment, you're investing so much more on the upfront, you know, you got to hope. All those guys that are making that investment are hoping the diesel doesn't go down by 70 cents a gallon, because if it does, it's going to tear up that model they built to build out the ROI on that equipment. So.
What's the current credit crunch, if it continues, doing to replacements?
It's tough, and you know, and it's a good space for Robinson until today. A debt-free company, when we made this acquisition, we still have a strong balance sheet, but that's where we get, and these guys can probably attest, we get a lot of carrier following from that ability, from our ability to help them with free cash flow. Your smaller to mid-sized haulers, you know, it's hard for them to go into a bank and say, hey, I want to order 5 brand-new CNG trucks. It's going to be a little tougher to do, so that maybe they're running on older equipment, they're doing different things. So cash flow becomes so critical in their business. So whether it be Robinson or, again, paying as a shipper consistently, maybe a little quicker to help those guys out, you know, 25 days instead of 30 for some of these guys makes a big difference in how they're running and how they're working through that. So, but from a general perspective, yeah, I think the small to mid-sized guys suffer in that market, in this credit crunch the last few years, and they look for, whether it be a shipper or Robinson, somebody they count on for consistent cash flow to run their business better. You know, it gets so tough on those guys when you go to a, you know, hey, my terms are 45 days, and by the time I process paperwork, it's going to be 60. You know, that makes a big difference for a lot of those fleets and how they're able to add equipment, how they're able to operate. And literally, for some of those guys, trace it back probably even to equipment maintenance, tire replacement. They're making decisions on when they're going to make those upgrades based on cash flow on their side of the business.
You continuing to have problems finding drivers that can meet the port entry requirements?
I'd say it varies by the port, but yeah, I mean, it's a tougher market. A lot of those ports, some enterprising folks have set up the escort services where they have a driver who will drive your equipment into the port for you for a fee, those kind of things, which, you know, you park outside the gate, they have a guy jump in, drive your truck into the port, load it, and bring it back to you. There was a need in the market there for that, so there weren't as many guys registered, particularly guys that just happened to be coming through. So whether it be Robinson, another broker, you know, if you don't have the same driver going every day, you might not want to take the time and the money to invest in Twit card stuff. So those escort services at some ports have been a real gap closer for some of those carriers to be able to continue to operate there with a fairly minimal investment on each load. So.
Any other questions? Well, Darryl, thank you.
Thank you.
We've got a little time, so if you need to make some calls, our next session is going to be at 11 o'clock, taking a new look at biochar. And this is going to be a very interesting session, so please be back in time. And since most of us can't get a signal in this room, you probably need a little telephone.